Well, I thought I'd start by just asking you what you were thinking by having so many tragedies happen in such a short space of time, so that by the time we have come to the end of the first page, she has lost her husband, she's lost her child, she's lost her mother. So I just was wondering if you could speak to us about what those tragedies meant for her. Like, did they sort of reveal who she was? Did they strip it away? She's lost everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in fiction, one of the things they say is not to have too many coincidences. So I thought, we'll get rid of all the coincidences right at the beginning of the book. That's part of it. But this was the other part. In a way, this book was sort of written for my mother. I didn't realize that until I was halfway through. My mother has Alzheimer's. She doesn't quite understand I've written this new book, but that's okay. But what I kind of wanted to do was, you know, my mother was born in a time, she's 90 now, was born in a time where women did the more traditional thing. And she's a very intelligent woman. She studied to be a pharmacist. She actually wanted to be a doctor. But once the children were born, she quit her job and took care of us, you know. And I've always thought, what would my mother's life have been like if, you know, she didn't have all these traditional female responsibilities, you know, looking after family, and we had tons of extended family as well, and, you know, and children are demanding of all kinds of things, and my dad as well. So I just took everything away and said, what if I put my mother into a modern setting? And so I created a character sort of based somewhat on her, put her into a world where, you know, her career could be everything, or what she thought she wanted could have been everything, and took everything away and go, okay, let's see what happens to your life now. So that was kind of the impetus originally behind it. And that's sort of how it started out. I think it became many other things as well after that. But
well, you've described this, I think, in interviews as your women's novel. So I think that the mother was one prism, one way to look at that. And but again, going back to Gail and her complete isolation, because you write something that I think was quite difficult for the Hong Kong audience to conceive of, which is the unlikely friendship that develops between Gail's servant, her employee, Conchita, and herself, because she has no one left to speak to, really. Like, the intimacy that I suspect many people know about in Hong Kong but don't own up to. Mm-hmm. So there's no one left to... At one point, I think Conchita is actually putting her to bed and lecturing her about, again, how she is reacting to the suffering that she's experiencing.
Well, yes, that's true. I mean, I do call it... I realized also that I was writing my woman's book. You know, I was trying to write my woman's book with my last novel, and then halfway through I realized, nope, it's a book about Hong Kong, so we'll kill that one. And then this became the woman's book. Quite interestingly, while I was working on this book, I used to have a corporate marketing background. Did that for about 18 years. And when I was thinking about this book at that point, I remembered at one point encountering three professional women in three different industries, all very quite highly placed in their positions, all of whom had the exact same experience. Their husbands left them for a younger woman. They had the child, and now they were the single parent looking after the child. Mm-hmm. And with one of these women...
This is in Hong Kong?
This was in Hong Kong. Right. And one was Chinese, Hong Kong Chinese. One was sort of American Chinese, and one was an English woman. And they were married to various different men. I think the Hong Kong Chinese was married to an English man, and et cetera. But I thought, so what happens to their lives, their personal lives? And I remember being invited home to one of their homes one time for dinner, and this was the Chinese woman. She said... She had her son, and, you know, her son was sort of misbehaving at dinner, you know, kids, you know. And you know, we had dinner, and then she said, well, you know, most evenings I come home, I have dinner. On Saturdays, I go to my swimming pool, my gym, and I do my laps there. I get some exercise. And then the week begins again, and that's pretty much it. And I thought, you know, God, you know, let's figure out what happens to these women, you know. And she was a really bright, very... successful women in advertising, and I thought, you know, is this the lot of women? Is this what happened? Is this what feminism was for? Because I'm an ardent feminist, and I thought, no, it's got to be something else. I've got to work it out. So let's
put a woman
in.
Well, I think to that end, can you read a passage which sounds quite like that experience that you have between Gail and one of her colleagues at the bank, who's a lawyer?
Oh.
And they're different generations, but neither of them are particularly happy or have gotten what they want. And I think it's so interesting because you compare their lives to the mothers who, you know, was, I believe you say early on, was sold into prostitution in Shanghai, pre-war mm-hmm. Shanghai,
yeah.
and had quite a hard life, but was really kind of savvy about her choices. And she mm-hmm. just seems a much less constrained character than these two highly educated people
right.
who have everything. And so I just wasn't sure what sort of statement you're making about women's lives. It's quite bleak, especially for an ardent feminist. It's just if, you know,
it's
nobody
tough.
Quite gets what they want, because Perry, the lawyer, her husband has also... Well, I suppose she kicked him out, didn't she? Well, anyway,
she did, yeah. Okay, mm-hmm. so that Perry, she's a younger woman, and she's a lawyer at the investment bank that they work at together. And Perry's husband had been caught up in some kind of financial scandal. And so they're separated. They're not divorced. But, you know, and so she's with the child in their Brooklyn brownstone. And Gail's visiting in New York on a business trip. And she's been offered a job to move to New York. And she's sort of saying, well, about the job, I'm sort of already doing this job, but, you know, I'm not sure about moving. She said, the problem is, it's not about the money. If it were, the decision would be easy. Perry was envious. Heck, I quit in a flash and go work part-time for a nonprofit. I even know which one. The point is, you wouldn't catch me working in your situation. You're fortunate. You know what you want. But, Gail, surely you knew what you wanted once, right? Love, Gail replied without hesitation, and family. So, you know?
So I think neither of them have quite had what they wanted.
Not quite, no.
So another thing that I found very interesting about this book was the role that class plays in it. Because I think, you know, perhaps, you know, looking at China through, you know, in the post-Maoist age, you know, we're accustomed to saying there, you know, there's no class. He declared that the colonial, you know, the colonial era has passed. But it's interesting because it seems like the Cantonese have adopted all the nomenclature of their former English colonial administrators. And anyway, so I make that point just to say that how unlikely the friendship is between Conchita or Gail. Do you feel it so?
I think it is. I mean, I think most... I don't know how familiar you are, but perhaps you do know that in Hong Kong, a large number of the... domestic helpers are from the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And it's very much a kind of indentured servitude, because they come and they live in your home. Mm-hmm. They get a leave once every... By law, they only get leave once every 2 years for a month.
And many times, the apartments wouldn't even be the size of this platform.
Right.
I mean, this would be a generous-sized apartment in Hong Kong. Just work, because real estate is at a premium.
Real estate is a huge premium. And in fact, even in what we would call the projects in America, which would be public housing in Hong Kong, people have domestic helpers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, of course, in sort of an upper middle class setting like this, Gail would have a helper. And often the helpers are brought in to look after the children. So there's a great intimacy in that sort of connection.
Right. So you feel like, did you observe friendships like this at close hand?
Oh,
did you experience them? Because there's another passage perhaps you might read, which is the Filipina helpers.
Talking among themselves, yeah.
Exactly, like bitching to each other on the staircase about the employers in Tagalog.
Yeah.
Do you have that passage to
read?
Yes,
I do. Yeah. I can read that for you. It is true. I mean, I saw a lot of families with Filipino... I have no children, so I've never had this issue. I actually have Filipino helpers now in our home for my mother. And that's a different thing. And both my sister and I organized this, you know, to take care of my mother. But we were both very uncomfortable. We both ourselves have never wanted to have a helper at home, even though we kind of grew up in a world... We had Chinese helpers when we were kids. There were three when I was a child. And I remember even as a child thinking... You mean...
There's
no privacy.
Right.
And I also... there were three women living together in one room.
Mm-hmm.
And they were grown women, you know. And I remember one time realizing that my helper, my ama, had a child of her own. And it suddenly struck me. It's like, you mean she doesn't just take care of me? You know, it's like, whoa. And then I suddenly thought, oh, my God, that's terrible. She doesn't see her child. And very young, I kind of had this shock. But anyway, here is... you know, because Conchita, now that Gail's mother has died, is thinking she might as well leave, you know, but she actually wanted to leave earlier, but fair to say, Gail is a rather tough employer. So Conchita's on the stairwell, and she's talking to Bonnie, who's a friend from downstairs, and she says that night, this is the night after the wake, I think, yeah. It seems mean to abandon her now. Bonnie shook her head. You're too soft. You should have left her last year like you were going to. The extra money isn't worth it. It's not just the money. She asked me to stay for her mother. I couldn't refuse. Macedo pays for everything her mother needs. A pretty good daughter, right? It's tough, you know, being alone like her with only her mother. You've still got your mother, too. And what about your children? Conchita frowned. She didn't like it when Bonnie brought up family back home. Some things you didn't bother thinking about. That's different. Why? Because we're not Chinese? Because Filipino women are supposed to kiss the world's ass? Because we didn't go to Harvard like her? Wake up, woman! Bonnie, an out-of-work math teacher, had finally conceded to domestic work in Hong Kong because her father was ill and needed money for medical care. No, it's just different, she replied. Besides, my mother looks after them. You're not making sense. I'm part of my family, no matter what. You know, her, well... Yes, but you're not her mother, are you? The younger woman counted, exasperated. Conchita, at 35, had been in Hong Kong too long, Bonnie decided. No way she'd work your 10 years, no matter how much money she made. No way. Especially not if she had a chance for a real life back home, the way Conchita now had, because her husband finally agreed to get work in the Middle East, mostly because Bonnie prodded Conchita into forcing him off his butt. Filipino women, Bonnie believed, were their own worst enemies. Conchita could learn a few lessons from that Cedo woman who seemed so focused on herself that nothing and no one stood in the way of what she wanted.
It's only occurred to me now what a radical choice it was to make Conchita the moral center of the novel, which you did, just because I think a lot of times in Hong Kong, the role of the Filipina, as you say, they are not always well treated.
We've had some terrible cases. And it's interesting, in talking to sort of Filipino helpers, they often say things like, well, they much rather work for a Western family because, first of all, the Westerners live in bigger homes and they get treated better. They get treated more like one of the family. And it is noticeable. You'll see, like, with a Western family or a mixed-race family, quite often, the helper will be there at restaurants, at dinners and things. But like my own mother, for example, before she was quite, you know, her Alzheimer's a little bit worse now, but earlier, you know, we had a helper and we would say, well, you know, ask her to come out to have dinner with us. And my mother was like, what's she doing out here? You know, okay, Mom, we won't do this. All right.
There are a number of times in this book when I think you turn stereotypes on their heads. And one of the most interesting points for me was something you say about innocence. You say there's no such thing as innocence, only an absence of guilt. And I bring this up because, like, you know, with Conchita, she's an unlikely moral center. And this innocence is in the context of the mother who was, for much of her life, a prostitute. So there's no such thing as innocence, only the absence of guilt. I wonder if you can speak about what innocence means in that context.
Yeah, because I try to think about Gail as a kind of innocent. She's, for example, you know, she's a sexual innocent. She's only ever had one lover, her husband, her ex-husband.
Not by the end of the novel.
Not by the end of the novel, no. You know, you got to have her have sex somewhere along the way. So in a way, she's kind of innocent, but she's not really innocent. Mm-hmm. She's sort of just inexperienced.
Well, I think it was the mother who preserves this childlike attitude to life. And, you know, I think that she must have had so much of her vision of the world taken from songs and movies. Mm. And, you know, because Gail is still pretty, she's pretty hard.
She's pretty hard,
whereas the mother has somehow survived this incredibly, I don't even know the word for it, like,
it's
horrific
life.
With a real kind of sweetness intact. Like,
The mother teaches Gail how to dance. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was a dance hall girl, a taxi girl, I think is a term that used to be used before.
Like a chicken lady?
Like a chicken lady's a prostitute.
Mm-hmm. I didn't, apparently, she was insisting to me that everyone knew what a chicken lady was. And
yeah, well, in Hong Kong,
when I queried
lady,
that. Yeah. Can you say, so this is Cantonese?
Cantonese,
for,
You know, the mother has had this kind of life, but she also has had this relationship with this American man. He's a pilot, a former Flying Tigers pilot, and Gordy's father.
So just to be clear, the Flying Tigers fought with the Chinese against the Japanese in the Second World War, right?
She has had this relationship, and of course it's one way she thinks of it as a kind of love, and there was a sort of love there. Mm-hmm. And so she retains a kind of innocence, a kind of hope. Because one of the things she always believed was that mm-hmm. the for the longest time, she hoped that the man would leave his wife and marry her, but there was just no way this was going to happen.
Well, especially, I think he was a blue blood, a Brahmin.
He was
wasn't
quite
he?
A blue blood. Mm-hmm. Well, it's his wife was a blue blood. He came from a more sort of kind of a nouveau riche background, but married into blue blood. You know, you got to have something like that, too. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that her innocence is, and then, you know, she's in this world of pop music and song and things like that, and, you know, she dances, but there's also a kind of a desire for a kind of purity when it's no longer there.
Yes.
And in that, well, she has another lover as well later, after the Agale's father no longer comes back into her life. You know, there's this other man that she sees, the only one that...
Who teaches her how to trade the stock market, I think.
Oh,
he?
No, that's a rich guy.
Oh, it's another man.
Yeah, this is another man. This is the guy that she actually loves. And the one that she doesn't charge money for.
Oh.
Okay, it's the only one that came to her bed without ever having to pay, you know. So she retains a kind of innocence in believing that this kind of love can survive. But, of course, it's kind of a doomed relationship, too. It's not one that's very happy.
I found her such a beguiling character. And yet, at the same time, even though Gail's father, for him, she probably was the love of his life, he doesn't know her real name.
No.
I found that fascinating that you, and again, I thought quite a bleak thing to say about love, because you seem to be questioning how much any of us ever really know each other. So the father knows her dance hall name, which is
Falong, which means flower dragon.
But he doesn't know her real name.
Yeah, it's funny because actually I don't know her real name. But actually, Anna had asked me that when we were working on the novel. I said, you know, I don't. She never told me her real name, so she just doesn't have a real name. Mm-hmm. She was sort of sold into sort of sex slavery quite young, so I just kept her with this sort of mythical name and kept her like a slightly mythical character in a way.
I suppose this leads into one of the other points which I found so interesting, which is how your characters invent themselves by lying and deception. It's just nobody...
Yeah.
So Falong tries so hard to recast herself and just isn't quite able to, because one of my favorite passages... You speak about the different languages that she uses. So it's English. Do you remember this
English,
offhand?
English, Cantonese, Mandarin.
So if she wants to abuse, if she wants to abuse somebody, she speaks Cantonese. If she wants to impress somebody, she speaks English.
Yeah.
And if she wants, and Mandarin is for official.
When she wants to impress people, she uses Mandarin. Mm-hmm. And you know, but
when heaven and earth are falling,
shudders, she slips into her native Shanghainese, because that's what we tend to default to the language of our childhood and, you know, of intimacy, you know, when things get really difficult. I know my mother, who has lived in, both my parents are from Indonesia, and my mother, who's lived in Hong Kong for a great part of her life, and she speaks English to us, but she does speak Cantonese also, but her Cantonese is kind of shaky. But I noticed that sometimes, and especially in her early stages of Alzheimer's, she would slip and speak to me in Indonesian, and I would have to say to her, "Mommy, I don't understand you. You have to speak to me in English." And she'd go, "Oh yeah, that's right. You're my kid who doesn't speak Indonesian," you know, sort of. And I do see how people do go back to, and I catch myself sometimes because I speak both Cantonese and English as the two main languages. And there's some things. I have a girlfriend who's in the same boat. We realize that we only count in Cantonese. To say a phone number, the only number that you have to sort of know that I can say in English is my social security number, because I learned it in American. But every other number, even my passport, which is a US passport, and my Hong Kong ID card, my bank numbers and things like that, I have to say them, phone numbers, I have to say them in Cantonese.
I think in Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, he talks about how much easier numbers are in Chinese, because actually the language
shorter.
For numbers in English is quite counterintuitive. Like if you think that we have a lot of strange, you know, 13, 15, 11, it's not, whereas 11. In Chinese it's one and one.
Yeah, right. 10 and 1 is 11, so it's, yeah.
Right. Well, but back to the question of identity, I think that the mother really, she holds on to her sense of who she is, even if she lies to create herself for other people. And in fact, I want to ask you about something she says to Gail, which is, you know, she doesn't want to move to Hong Kong Island. And I thought that was fascinating, because so many people, like, that's, you're seen to have arrived, like when you have an address in the Peak or certain roads in the mid-levels or perhaps, you know, you know, Repulse Bay. But she wants to stay in Kowloon because when, what is it she says to Gail? We're part of
Dai Lok. We're part of the mainland. Dai Lok is the term for the mainland, meaning the big continent. But it sounds like the big six. Mm-hmm. So this is a homonym for six. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I was wondering, can you speak about what that means, Dai Luk means for mm-hmm. Gail as yeah. a, you know...
As a Hong Kong person, really.
Right, yeah. And for her mother. Mm-hmm. Like, what is the big continent? Like, what is that sense?
Well, I mean, Hong Kong has an interesting and kind of confused relationship with China, you know, because, of course, we were a British colony for so long. We also have a confused relationship with Britain. You know, this is part of the problem. But there were sort of two reasons I kind of did that with this Kowloon Hong Kong division. I mean, it's very short to get across the harbor, you know, and with a subway, you can just get across in 5 minutes. But I was a Kowloon girl. I was born in Kowloon. So I wanted to do a nod to the peninsula and say, hey, it's not so bad on this side. And also because Kowloon is really where more of the local population lives. Whereas Hong Kong Island, I mean, of course, there's a lot of local population mm-hmm. there, but most expatriates mm-hmm. live in Hong Kong Island. But also, I think the idea of, you know, when we were first given away to Britain, it started with Hong Kong Island, so this frog-like thing, it looks like a frog, and the Kowloon Peninsula, mm-hmm. so just the tip of the peninsula, which is the part connected to the mainland. Mm-hmm. And then later on, the treaty was changed so that, you know, it gave away what we call the new territories mm-hmm. for this sort of 99-year lease. Ridiculous thing. One of the last of the unequal treaties, I think they say.
Hey, I'm American.
Yeah, I know. So I think the complication of how Hong Kong people mm-hmm. feel about the mainland. So if you ask Hong Kong Chinese people today, so are you Chinese? Well, of course I am. But are you Chinese like the mainland? Well, no, I'm not. I'm Hong Kong Chinese. So mm-hmm. how do you make this distinction? Mm-hmm. And I think Gail would be somebody who would be more Hong Kong Chinese mm-hmm. than her mother. Mm-hmm. Her mother came from the mainland, and therefore her mother still has this connection in that way, which so many of an earlier generation mm-hmm. did. But by now we're into the second, third, fourth, fifth generation of people mm-hmm. born in Hong Kong, mm-hmm. who, you know, whose ancestors came from the mainland.
Well, I feel like, in a sense, Hong Kong is your muse, because you wrote this book on three different continents, but you chose to set it yeah. in Hong Kong, for the most part. And I was wondering if you would respond to this quote, which is from a great Hong Kong observer, Akbar Abbas, who says that, in Hong Kong, the sense of the temporary is very strong. The city is not so much a place as a space of transit. It has always been and will perhaps always be a port in the most literal sense, a doorway, a point in between, even though the nature of the port has changed. So it's a place where everything floats, mm-hmm. Currencies, values, relationships. So what does that mean for Gail to be Hong Kong Chinese from that place?
Well, it's interesting for her because, of course, she does something that a lot of well-educated Hong Kong and smart kids mm-hmm. can do. She gets a scholarship and goes to like someplace like Harvard, mm-hmm. you know? And so she gets her degree, works in America, and then brings all that American experience back mm-hmm. to Hong Kong. That way you get a very well-paid job. Mm-hmm. So this idea that you can sort of transact between mm-hmm. places and mm-hmm. do that and yet still have a footing in mm-hmm. Hong Kong is interesting. But at the same time, you know, part of who you are, I'm thinking now of this sort of like this investment banker, lawyers, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. professors, what have you, who kind of have to transition between mm-hmm. these, recognize that your footing is firmer because you have a foot in the West as well mm-hmm. or somewhere else, you know. Mm-hmm. Today that's shifting, of course, mm-hmm. you know, it's often the China and outside of the mm-hmm. world and Hong Kong being somewhere in between. Hong Kong has always been this kind of in-between space. Mm-hmm.
You think it will always be?
I think so. Right now we're banking on our being the sort of exchange center for the renminbi is one possibility, I think, for keeping our footing as this sort of weird... We're called the Special Administrative Region. That's our official political designation. And a Hong Kong citizen as such can get a separate mm-hmm. passport. It's a different passport from a Chinese on the mainland. I don't know. I don't quite understand what will happen to her. I look ahead and try to see. Our languages are changing. Mm-hmm. Linguistically, it's getting quite interesting.
Really?
Because now we have three official mm-hmm. languages, Cantonese, Mandarin, and English, and which means we were once bilingual, or rather we were sort of not fluent in two languages. Now we will not be fluent in three, you know.
So another bleak view.
Yeah, this is the complaint of all the educators and all the school teachers. This is kind of like, how do we teach three languages? It's tough, you know.
Well, I thought it also might be interesting for the Asia Society if you talk about the character of Gordy, who studied Chinese. And I was thinking he sort of himself a relic, just because I think you had a lot of people in the sort of 60s, 70s, you know, before China was opened, who studied it, you know, for aesthetic reasons. It was the literature, the art. You know, now it's a language of business and international relations. But so Gordy is the last of these kind of dreamers, you know, who it really does seem like the nature of the Westerner has.
It was interesting because, of course, over the years, I've met a number of Americans who have studied Chinese, or, you know, Sinophiles and people like that. And
you make it sound like a condition, a Sinophile.
A Sinophile, it is. It's sort of like, or, you
Sinophilia.
Know, Anglophile or Francophile, whatever. But it, what always struck me was, like, they would know so much about Chinese culture, much more than I knew. You know, they had studied all this Chinese literature. They had read all the Tang and Song poets. I mean, I'd read a few, and then it's like, okay, next, you know. Because my schooling was in Western literature. Mm-hmm. So this was kind of a really ironic thing. But I also, as I was researching the
Because your influences were Western,
more Western
weren't they?
Really,
saying,
yeah.
Right.
But my when I was researching Gordy's background, I had him go to Yale, and I was looking at, you know, what the curriculum was for somebody studying Chinese at the time. I talked to some people who had done this right around the same time Gordy would, and they said, well, you know, China was not a place you could go to. Mm-hmm. So everything you learned was outside of China.
It was an imaginary landscape.
It was an imaginary landscape.
Right.
I know one of the very prominent of Chinese translators of Tang poetry and Song poetry, and he said, you know, he had never been to China. And I was, like, stunned when he told me that. And he's
so
a wonderful
translator. Perhaps he's expecting
translator.
Only karst mountains and mists, and it
well,
would break his heart.
It,
he
I almost
saw
think
Shanghai.
It would, you know. I have the same experience. I went to Moscow once for 4 days back in 1981. It's a long, complicated story why I ended up there. I took a train from Athens. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, well before modern Russia and well before all the, you know, economy had changed and everything. So things were rather regimented and organized. And I just walked into this picture book vision of Red Square. And I looked at that. And, you know, and of course time has changed and time has passed. I walked into the marble sort of subway. And it was just incredible to me to see this. So years later, I think about Russia and how I'd like to go and see it again. And I feel like I almost can't.
Mm.
I don't want to destroy that image. And you know, all the Russian literature you read, I think I went to see Dostoevsky's grave. You know, it was just like, this is what drew me to Russia, is the literature, the culture, the things I've heard.
You don't want
to
find McDonald's in Red Square?
No, not really. You know, I mean, I've seen McDonald's in Paris. That was enough. You know, like, so.
Well, I think that it's kind of interesting also to remark that Gordy is one of your inverted stereotypes. Like,
yeah.
Because Gale is the tough as nails son that, you know, the flying tiger always wanted, and Gordy is the dreamer who vacuums when he gets upset. And,
yeah.
And I was hoping that since we're almost near Q&A time, that you would close with the passage in which Gordy educates Gale about a present her mother gave her.
So, I mean, here you have this half-brother and sister who have a rather uneasy relationship. They're sort of, you know, strangers, familiar strangers. Gordy and Gale didn't actually meet until Gale was 18 or 17 or so. And so what he does, where are the cups? It's the cups, isn't it? Yeah. Hang on a second. Here we go. So this is towards the end of the book, and they've become a little bit less strangers now because by circumstance they're thrown together. And Gordy is at Gail's home. She finally lets him into her home. And she takes out these cups to serve tea. And he sees them and he's stunned. He's horrified. He held up the cup to the light and he said, "What on earth it is?" He leaned forward and picked up its mate, which was still empty. "Damn, these are the ones, but they were stolen or lost or something," I thought. He poured the tea back into the pot. "Gale, have you any idea what these are worth?" "Mom gave her 39th birthday, the night she cursed out her mother, the present she had received indifferently because she thought it was just an excuse for Mom to tell on Jason, because this is the night her mother tells her that I think your husband is cheating on you, you know? And she says, 'How dare you? You're wrong, you know?' And her mother gives her these cups and says, 'Have you ever seen anything like them before?' 'Didn't you know,' Gordy said, dad found them for her. They're wine cups, a couple of hundred years old, maybe older. He wiped the cup dry with his handkerchief, taking care not to soil the monogram, and held it up against the light. See the figure of the Buddha? It's engraved into the biscuit before the glaze goes on. Each one's hand-potted. Gail knelt next to Gaudi, who was seated in the armchair, to take a closer look. He held up the other cup to a similar scrutiny, pointing at its see-through crane pattern. He said, "Aren't they exquisite? Blanc de Chine, 18th century most likely, possibly earlier. You might have heard of them referred to as Fuyao or Chanchi from Fujian province. They first appeared around the 13th or 14th centuries as ceremonial vessels. This Buddha one is the much rarer of the two." "I had no idea." She handled them delicately, gazing at their milky translucent. "And all this time, I thought that Mom could at least have gotten me a matching set of teacups."
Do you want to do questions and answers now?
Okay, let's do so. Questions? I think he went to get a microphone. I'll get a drink of water. Michael has.
Can you talk a little bit about why you choose to write in English?
Mm-hmm. It's my main language, actually. You know, my parents, both being from Indonesia, Cantonese was not their native language. They're Chinese Indonesian, or the Hua Chao or Hua Kyu, as they're called, the overseas Chinese. My father's other language was Mandarin. He studied Chinese. He actually was in university in Shanghai when 49 happened, and he ended up in Hong Kong. And my mother ended up in Hong Kong. She was in Singapore for her schooling, and then, you know, the war broke out, and she went back to Indonesia, and then she came to Hong Kong after the war to finish her high school because she could do it in English. So as a result, they, you know, my parents have this complicated linguistic background. Their first language is sort of the Javanese dialect, and that's what they speak to each other. My father can actually read formal Indonesian, the Bahasa that is used now. My mother can't actually read Bahasa that well. They both studied Chinese, but my mother's Chinese was sort of rudimentary. So in Hong Kong, Cantonese would have been the language to speak to us, but they kind of couldn't. And my father, not being the one to take on his children's education, being a, you know, very Chinese father, kind of left it to my mom. So my mom's like, "What? I can't teach them Cantonese." So she said, "Well, let's speak to them in English, because at least it was a British colony, it would be the language of education." But I learned Cantonese at school, but it was always not the language of home. And as a kid, I read English school books and everything, and English fairy tales, and you know, books from all over the world. And I had to study Chinese, but I hated it. It was so difficult. I finally flunked out around fifth grade, and I went and took French in secondary school. But later on, as a writer, I kind of felt like, you know, I really ought to have some literacy. So I went and studied Mandarin, but I studied it in Massachusetts. So I have this complicated, you know, when if you know Chinese and you have to input Chinese into a computer, I have to input it using pinyin, because that's the way I can actually read Chinese better. So I inputted it in Mandarin, but then I speak Cantonese much, much better than I speak Mandarin, because my Mandarin is, you know, sort of like, it's good when I've been practicing it, but then when I spend too much time in Hong Kong, they say, "Oh, you're from Hong Kong in Beijing," because they can hear my accent right away, you know. So I have this weird sort of complicated background, and for the longest time I wondered about writing in English, because it seems strange in a way, but it was sort of also natural. But once I started publishing books, it did seem strange, because people would always ask this question, and I just kind of finally sort of think, I guess that's just the language I use, you know. And it is the kind of transnational, international language now, so it takes me back and forth, which is kind of nice. But I keep trying to put Chinese into my English, and that's the thing I try to do a lot, because I think that there is a Chinese English, like when you have two characters speaking and they're speaking in Chinese, but you have to render it in English, you kind of have to do that. So I wind up thinking about this kind of thing a lot, but it's also the compromise of having been raised in a colony, you know, when the English was the sort of language of the elite, you know, and this, that was the superior language. Not, you know, but whatever. That's what happened to me. So, a long way of answering the question.
I'm just curious, how did your MFA help you?
My MFA?
Yeah.
It was interesting. My MFA actually was very transformative for me. I had been working, I'd done an undergraduate degree, a bachelor's degree in English literature, which is a straight literature degree, and I think I took one class in creative writing. I'd never even heard of such a thing. I was like amazed. Only in America, they let you actually get credit for doing what you like doing, you know? So I went back home and I worked for about 6-7 years, and I had never even heard of an MFA. And one day I was I used to work for an airline, so I would get all these like airline tickets, free tickets. So I flew to Greece because I thought, why not? You know, you got to go where the cradle of Western civilization is. And I'm sitting in this cafeteria, and this man sits down who looks like Hemingway, and we start talking. Turns out, and then he tells me about MFAs. He says, well, if you're a writer, you really should try to do these. And I was like, really? So I did. I wound up doing the one at University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and it was very transformative in that it was the first time in my life I actually realized other people do this and this is real. And if you want to do this, you better take yourself seriously. And it's not just about getting a book published. I published a little bit of stories before I got my MFA, and I finished a novel in the middle of my MFA, and I kept trying to get it published. I rewrote that novel entirely, and in the end I never published it, but it was my practice novel and it was okay. And I began to understand that what you do as a writer is you write, and then whatever comes from that comes, and that's what came. I think once I could understand that it was just something you must take as a part of your life, and the MFA was the place that made me do that, which is one of the reasons I'm still involved. I teach at Vermont, and now I've started a new program in Hong Kong for sort of Asian writers in English, and this is something that I feel helps people who aspire to write, because you know especially in Asia, nobody tells you can be a writer. You know, I loved to read as a kid. I used to write stories and things, and I'd go to the library and I'd look at all these books and look at the names on the spines, and it never dawned on me that these were real people. It was like, these are just books, right? You know, they're dead anyway, right? So, and it is not till I finally sort of began to conceive of myself as one of those people who did that I could really see it. And I think the MFA was very instrumental in helping me do that. It also taught me to read literature differently. I learned to read it like a writer, not like a literary critic, where you're constantly looking for you're constantly analyzing it from a different standpoint and writing papers about it. So.
It strikes me that you have what I would refer to as a third culture kid background.
Yes.
And I wonder if you find that coming up in your writing and throughout your various books, and what that looks like or sounds like in them.
That's an interesting observation, because, of course, the term third culture kid is a much more contemporary term. And, you know, I just wrote all these books, and I have these sort of third culture kind of characters in my books, young kids as well as, you know, adults, etc. And I find the reaction from the third culture kid generation now is very gratifying, because it suddenly makes me realize I was just ahead of my time. I was born too early, because I find that I can talk to a lot of people who now have this experience and talk in terms of third culture. But in my time, there was no such a thing. There were a small group of us who were Indonesian Chinese who spoke English and also spoke Cantonese, but may or may not speak Indonesian, and we just didn't know where to put ourselves. We would meet every year. I remember this as a kid very distinctly. My aunt would get dressed up in the sarong kabaya, and we'd go to the Indonesian consulate and play the egg and spoon race or whatever, or the potato sack race at the Indonesian Independence Day on the 17th of August. And I had no idea what this really meant to me, except that I could sing the Indonesian national anthem. This is about as much Indonesian as I know. That and food, of course, you know, because my mother was a wonderful cook, and she cooked all this Indonesian food. So this rather strange sense of who you are gets into a lot of my work. I mean, and Gail is sort of grappling with who she is. She's biracial, but it's an uncomfortable biracial situation because, of course, she's illegitimate and has had to hide that much of her life. So, and this was the condition. The book is also dedicated to my two best friends, one of whom I grew up with. She is a Eurasian girl, and it was tough being a Eurasian kid in the 60s because the only people who were either very wealthy or the children of prostitutes. And she was someone in between, and there was no place for a third culture kid like her yet in those days. And the other person that's dedicated to is my other best friend from college, who is this very, very American-looking Irish-American gal who married a Hong Kong Chinese guy, and so her daughter, when she's out with her daughter, nobody thinks they're mother and daughter. You know, so I mean, all this sort of questions of identity and who you are and what you look like. I mean, this, the way I look when I appear in America, I often would encounter people who would say, oh, you speak English very well. And I'm like, yes, thank you very much. I learned to say thank you very much. And I almost felt like I should sort of slip into some kind of, you know, grammatical lapse just to reassure them. But, it, you know, it's hard because people have expectations when depending on how you look, who you are, and all that. And third culture kids are defying that expectations. And I think that's what I try to address in a lot of my work, you know.
Hey, thanks for the reading. And I am very interested in the intersection of art and politics. And all the mediums that that try and kind of address these sorts of global and personal issues, and specifically in just the sections that you read here, we were dealing with both the Asian economic crisis, home care workers, and things along those lines. And aside from the obvious serendipity of the creative process, where you start looking somewhere and you know things do materialize as you do that, do you have any sort of specific when you sit down to write, do you have any sort of intentions? Like, I plan to actually address this economic crisis, or illustrate through, or this character you called the sex worker, a mythological figure. You know, did you deliberately set out to actually address that through sort of the creation of that character?
Yeah. It's interesting with this book because it began a long time ago. When I first set out to write it, I kind of knew that I wanted these deaths to open it. But that was just a plot thing. So I just kind of knew that and nothing else, in a way. I had this sense that I wanted to try to get a character in there who was working in sort of the business finance world, because that was sort of the world I was in myself. And I wanted to create that, because often characters in contemporary fiction, especially in American fiction, are always artistic in some way, but you know, it's kind of like I wanted a non-artistic character. You know, it's like I'm tired of all these artists. I already know them. I wanted to try to like make somebody like that real on the page. And of course, in the corporate world, which I was in for many years, one of the things that I was very conscious of, and that I was conscious about as I was writing it, was the person who is somebody like Gail, who's kind of a local staff in Asia, but who's also kind of bridging across. And then there's the American staff, and then there's the real local staff. And there are different terms of employment for people like that. There are very different terms of what they can expect to be their career. And I previous to that, worked for British corporations, which were even more hierarchical and layered, and it were very, you know, it was very stratified. And I often looked at that and thought, what if I had been born American and just went out into the workforce? It would be so different, you know? But here, because it's in Asia, it's like this, you know? So I thought this would be something to set up and discuss and think about in a novel. And Gail seemed like a perfect kind of character to do that with, because I could show it from both sides. But she kind of has to work both sides. When I worked in management for Federal Express, for example, and I was definitely one of those two sides people, you know. On the one hand, you had to go out and sing karaoke in Chinese with your fellow managers so that they would not think you were too foreign. On the other hand, you had to go drinking with all these guys from the South and talk about, you know, football and baseball. I can't talk about football. I can't talk about baseball, though. And so that you will be accepted by them. And I was kind of like, huh? How do you do this, too, you know? So, and it's often the condition for those middle management people, which is what I was, you know. So that was one of the issues or sort of sociological, political, whatever you want to call it. That
I think Gail doesn't quite successfully bridge that gap, does she? Like, she's always getting kind of
caught in the
well, it's just, I was thinking of the colleagues, like, when her mother dies, like, they, you say that you incorporate Chinese into the text, like, they have a lot of sort of Cantonese aphorisms for getting above yourself.
Yes.
Is that when people are too proud, look what happens.
Yeah.
So
the idea of pride,
she was less successful than you, I think.
Well, I think Gail also, she fell into the woman trap thing of the superwoman trap, I call it, that you've got to do everything perfectly. And I never believed that to be true. I've never believed that you can. Well, maybe some people can, but I sure as heck can't, you know. You know, it's difficult, all these roles. It's like, it's not easy to be a mother. It's not easy to be, you know, a teacher. It's not easy to be anything, you know. It's not easy to be a person in management or whatever, you know. It's not easy to be a wife. I think that's one of the harder roles, actually. So,